Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Kia routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. We're in East Lansing. Nittany Lions at Michigan State tonight at 6:30 at Breslin. Before we get to Joe Marino and talk about the NFL draft, time now for our play-by-play call of the day.
Willis up the right side. Willis to the right wing. Fake, shoots a three for the win. No good. Kentucky wins over Vanderbilt on a driving Quan A. Green layup. 83-81.
Tough one for Vanderbilt. Twice they had Kentucky on the ropes this season, and each time Kentucky managed to escape. First time was just on a bad play by Vanderbilt. This time Kentucky made a couple of big plays down the stretch, and they won it in overtime. Joe Marino joins us. Joe, welcome. It's great to have you on board.
Yeah, absolutely. Appreciate you guys reaching out, and certainly an exciting time of year for us NFL draft guys.
Yeah, let's get to it, because Alex Smith gets dealt from Kansas City to Washington. Now that means Kirk Cousins, there's no doubt he's on the move. So with him being on the move, does that adjust any draft thinking based on who needs quarterbacks and who doesn't?
Yeah, I think this is one of the first important dominoes to fall. In my latest mock draft, which was dropped on Saturday, I had six quarterbacks drafted in the first round, one of those being number 13 to the Washington Redskins. Now, I don't think that them acquiring 34-year-old Alex Smith precludes them from drafting a quarterback, but it's certainly, with the commitment they made to him, over $70 million guaranteed across four seasons, you think that he's going to be their guy for a while. It doesn't necessarily make them a first-round landing spot. Now, the next guy, obviously, is Kirk Cousins, you know, where he ultimately lands. And everybody that I've spoke to says he's going to the highest bidder. And so that makes me look at the teams with the money that need a quarterback. And so, you know, the teams that come to mind are Cleveland Browns, over $100 million in cap space. New York Jets, I think, are around $70 million in cap space. So both of those teams can really front-load a contract to Kirk Cousins and land him. And so I think if either one of those teams lands Kirk Cousins, they're out of the quarterback mix. And so, you know, you start seeing more opportunities for maybe some trades in the draft, some more opportunities for different players to reach different landmarks in the draft that maybe we didn't expect. So those were two. Well, we've already had one domino in Alex Smith, and the next one's Kirk Cousins, which will play a big factor in ultimately the landscape of the 2018 NFL draft.
Say for the heck of it that Kirk Cousins goes to Cleveland. They have a lot of cap space. They got a lot of money. Does that open the door for the Browns to select Saquon Barkley first overall?
I think so. I think the NFL has seen the value of high investments in running back. Todd Gurley, top 10 pick. Ezekiel Elliott, a top 4 pick. Leonard Fournette, a top 5 pick. I don't think any one of those teams has any regrets about those draft picks and the impact they've become on those teams, and them being the focal point of the offense and really being able to shoulder and run the offense through those guys. We've seen Christian McCaffrey go in the top 10, and obviously Alvin Kamara is not a first-round pick, but if he was taken in the top 10 and put up the season he had last year, you know, they wouldn't have had any regrets about that either. So the value of the running back, I think, is starting to shift a little bit, where it went away for a while, and I thought that was more to do with the running backs available. It seems like there's an uptick right now in the quality of the top-end prospects at running back. And so it's shifting the dynamics a bit in the NFL, and teams have invested highly in running backs. And, you know, should Kirk Cousins go to the Browns, the quarterback's out. They're going to guarantee $90 million or in that ballpark to Kirk Cousins. And so another quarterback's not going to be part of the mix. And so you start looking at other positions, and you think that a Kirk Cousins, Saquon Barkley backfield to really anchor that offense behind a defense that actually had some success last year with some very good, exciting young talent, and you think that maybe, just maybe, that ship can be getting right out there in Cleveland.
The quarterbacks that are available in this draft, and you mentioned that on your mock draft, maybe six could go in the first round. Now, the top three that most people think of top three, I've seen two of the three in person. I've seen Sam Darnold, and I've seen Josh Allen in person. I did not see Josh Rosen in person. When you look at those three, is there any one of them that, in your opinion, is cable ready to get in there and just start playing right away, or are all of them still works in progress?
Yeah, I like Josh Rosen a lot. I think he's probably one of the most NFL-ready quarterbacks I've seen, certainly the first, the most NFL-ready quarterback since Andrew Luck, a guy that's, there's no guesswork involved. He's operated an NFL system at UCLA. He does everything you're looking for an NFL quarterback to do. He has a tremendous sense for reading coverage and throwing the football with accuracy to all three levels of the field. His poise in the pocket is very good. He doesn't give you much extending plays. He's a pure pocket guy, like a Matt Ryan type. But I have no questions about Josh Rosen being able to step in right away, given his experience in an NFL system, really be able to take the reins from day one. He's the guy that I feel is most ready.
Darnold, though, goes three-quarter and sometimes sidearm. How much of a concern is that?
I think it's a big concern, because if you look at Sam Darnold's overall mechanics, his footwork all the way through his release and his throwing motion are not something you see in successful NFL quarterbacks. I think it all has to be reworked, and there's not a lot of case studies that show that stuff really changes and improves. And so I think Sam Darnold's more rough around the edges than anyone's ready to admit. He's young. Obviously, the ceiling's very high. But from a mechanics and throwing arm perspective, he's got a lot of work to do. And, show me the list of guys with elongated releases that is so loopy like Sam Darnold's that have had success in the NFL. I can point to several that didn't, and I'm very concerned about that. And I think overall Sam Darnold's a high-end, high-ceiling prospect, but, let's not act like he's not rough around the edges.
And then there's Allen. In games that he played the last 2 years, Joe, against Power 5 opponents, he has a quarterback rating, if you translate it to the NFL, of 31.7. Is that a concern?
Yeah, I think Josh Allen's tape overall is a concern. You talk about playing quarterback in the NFL, it's about putting, five, six, seven different variables all together to execute a play, and starting with the footwork, to reading the defense, to understanding what good decisions are and being able to make those. I mean, A through F, he combining all of those things into one is a struggle for Allen. I think independently, he shows great traits. He shows great arm strength. He's got the look. He's got good footwork. He's got good accuracy. But when it all has to work together to be a consistent passer, he really struggles. I get it that he's got otherworldly physical traits, but, it really doesn't show up with any type of consistency. So, he's a guy that I think an NFL team's going to take in the top 10 or 15 picks. But, he's a guy that, we said rough around the edges for Sam Darnold, or even rougher for Josh Allen.
Right. A lot of people want to know about Baker Mayfield. What do you see?
Yeah, I like Baker Mayfield a lot. He's right there with Josh Rosen at the top of my quarterback board. I love a lot about the kid. He's extremely accurate. That's the first thing that really jumps off the tape when I watch Baker Mayfield, is he's extremely accurate to all levels of the field, and he knows how to read defenses and throw with anticipation. And so, we see so many guys coming into the NFL from college and they're point-and-shoot passers. They need guys to be established as open before they pull the trigger. Well, Baker Mayfield's a guy that knows how to sense where those throwing windows are going to be and knows where to put the football so that his receivers can create space. So, first and foremost, an extremely accurate quarterback that reads the field extremely well. Secondly, he's a wizard when things break down around him. Russell Wilson-like ability when things break down. Amid chaos, he really excels. His ability in the pocket and to get outside the pocket and extend plays is very, very good. So those are his two, traits that I like most about him. But, I think he's the total package. He's just not very tall. That's the issue. But he's checked in at the Senior Bowl over 6 foot tall, which is important. I think that right now, like even this conversation, the talk was about Allen, Darnold, and Rosen, but I think Baker Mayfield's firmly in this conversation. Okay. And, I think he's going to be able to win over an NFL locker room with no question. And he's a guy that I'm very high on in this quarterback class.
Non-quarterbacks, if you had to pick three guys, and you and I both know there's not a sure thing anywhere, it's still a jump from college to the pros. It's like trying to leap a canyon to get there. But give me three guys that you look at and say they've got the best chance to be sure things in the NFL.
Yeah, I think Quentin Nelson, the guard from Notre Dame. I mean, he's one of the best football players I've ever seen. Dominant. He's just absolutely dominant in all aspects of blocking. He's got great size. And he's just, I mean, he literally just overwhelms opponents with power, and he can move. He checks every box. The other guy, Tremaine Edmonds, a linebacker from Virginia Tech, he's 6'5", 236 pounds, middle linebacker type player with just ridiculous range for his size, his mobility for his size, his physicality playing into the line of scrimmage for his size is exceptional. He's got so much length. That makes him so effective, you know, as a blitzer, as a in pass coverage, because he's so long to work into throwing windows, and you know the amount of the margin for error in man coverage because of his length is really exceptional. He reads plays so well, and he takes such tight angles of football. I think he's, you know, a face of your defense type player, Tremaine Edmonds, and then Saquon Barkley. You know, I think this is a rare talent as well, where you've got a guy that has every physical trait needed to be a top of the line NFL running back. He does everything so well at a high level. You know, he can be that focal point of an NFL offense and a very good offense. So love what the skill set that Barkley offers. And so those three guys, if I need sure things and I'm picking in the top 10 and I'm not looking at a quarterback, that's where my eyes go.
What are your thoughts on Minka Fitzpatrick?
Yeah, you know, you only let me pick three, so he'd probably be the fourth
I love his interchangeable
upside. He could play corner and safety, really valuable skill set with all the different things he can do on the back end. He tackles well, he sees everything well and reacts, and he's got the ball skills that you look for in top of the first round cornerbacks and defensive backs that can really, you know, make game-changing plays. So he's right there as well, for sure.
I also think, Joe, that he has an ability at times, because you and I both know with all the sub-packages, he actually has the ability to play a little closer to the line of scrimmage if you need to, like a Malcolm Jenkins does.
That's my comp for him, Malcolm Jenkins, no question about it. Yeah, but, you know, you can do so much with him. And the way that offenses have evolved in the NFL, they challenge you in so many different ways, and they make you cover more ground than ever. So having these types of versatile players that can do so many different things, you know, you're going to get a player like that, a valuable chess piece for a defense in Minka Fitzpatrick.
All right, you don't just look at the first round. Give me a couple guys, Joe, that you think are going to have some value in the second, third rounds where, look, this is a seven-round draft. You're going to find value at a wide variety of places. So give me a couple of value guys that might not be first-round picks, but Joe Marino sitting there saying, that's a really good pick you just made.
Yeah, you know, the guy that just jumps to my mind is Andrew Brown. He's a defensive lineman for Virginia. A guy that I think can play multiple positions in an even or odd front. He's a tremendous point of attack player with really powerful hands, and he's very twitchy. So, you know, you think about a guy like Trey Flowers for the Patriots and how they're able to move him around and do so many different things and create some opportunities for him to win one-on-one battles. I think a player like that's going to evolve here in Andrew Brown. I really like Will Hernandez, the guard from UTEP. He's a powerful football player. I mean, you talk about the guys that can create movement and create space up front. You know, he roots defensive linemen out of gaps so well. And at the Senior Bowl last week, we saw, you know, some flexibility that I didn't think he had. So, you know, his ability to really slide and shut down gaps as a pass blocker really pop. So I kind of gravitate towards these interior players, these front seven guys. But those are the couple guys that really stand out when you think about, you know, day two, you're going to make a big impact and be really, really quality starters.
And we all know that the NFL is changing all the time. Sub packages are so important now. College game has also changed. What kind of influence are you seeing on the pro game now, actually from the college game, that then influences how you look at the draft board?
Yeah, I've really started to change the way I look at defensive players, where, you know, these pursuit style linebackers are so important because of the spread offenses and how much ground you have to cover. You need guys on the second level that can cover a lot of distance sideline to sideline and really get work behind them and being able to get depth in their pass drops. So, you know, there's a day and age where I would gravitate towards, you know, guys that have really good ability to play into the line of scrimmage and plug gaps and that type of thing. But now I'm gravitating more towards guys that can cover ground and really get outside the tackles and make plays. So that's a big thing. And then on offense, you need offensive linemen that can move. I think again, there's a day and age where you're looking for big dudes that can move people off the line of scrimmage. Now we need guys that can get out in space and make blocks and really work into the boundary, get to the second level and seal linebackers in pursuit. You know, it's so the foot speed and the ability to really move offensively on the from the offensive line is something that's very different because, you know, in the past it was, you know, who can move people, who can be a stalwart or just a big dude that can anchor. Now you've got to be able to move your feet.
This Super Bowl coming up is a perfect example of you don't need to have the highest of high draft picks to do things, although Aguilar is obviously a first-round pick. Jeffrey, of course, had been a high pick by the Chicago Bears. But how do you look at the wideouts? Where do you find the best value in wideouts, who that might be?
Well, for this year specifically, I don't know that there's a true alpha receiver that I'm prepared to, you know, funnel my passing game through. So, you know, I think the value is going to be on day two, and I think that's a lot of what you're seeing in a lot of the receivers that are part of these Super Bowl teams. You know, there's the top 10 receivers, you know, they really need to be an A.J. Green, Julio yeah. Jones, Odell Beckham type player. And last year, it did. I mean, obviously, the script's not written for John Ross, Mike Williams, and those folks drafted in the top 10 last year. But, you know, you're able to get these receivers that seem to be productive at different portions of the draft, and I think that hurts the value of the position. Oftentimes, so much of receiver play has to do with the offense that they're in and who the quarterback is and opportunity. It's so much of that defines, you know, these receivers. And so, you know, finding a guy that fits, that can complement the receivers that you have, I think that's another big thing is a lot of teams have this propensity to get receivers that replicate skill sets that are already on their team. And so having diverse group that can do different things and win in different ways and at different levels of the field gives you a well-rounded arsenal of receivers. And, you know, sometimes those guys that can complement aren't, you know, they're more niche players. And so you don't take niche players towards the early portions of the draft, and so the value a lot of times at receiver to round out your arsenal comes in the second, third, fourth round.
What about a guy like Calvin Ridley?
I like Calvin Ridley a lot. Route running, he knows how to separate. He's so sudden with his route breaks and how he sells his route stems to create leverage. Love that about him. He's going to be 24 as a rookie, so he's a little bit of an older prospect. And I think he can be a very high-quality wide receiver in the NFL, probably going to be my top receiver in the class. But it goes back, am I getting an A.J. Green or Julio Jones? Well, I don't think so, and that's why everybody wants to peg him to the Bears. Right there, I think they're picking 8 or 9, but I think that's a little bit too early for him where, you know, his value is going to be in the later portions of the first round, and then you start thinking about the Auden Tates and the Equanimeous St. Browns of this class and some of these other guys that you think can be productive guys on day two. You can get another player at another position and get your receiver help on day two.
Absolute pleasure, Joe. Really enjoyed knocking it around to the draft. Great stuff from you. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. I had a good time. Thank you.
Joe Marino joining us, talking about the NFL draft. Never too early to talk about the NFL draft. Never. We'll come back with more in a moment from East Lansing on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Well, it's the end of the month, so if you'd like digital media, give us a call. What? I'm just trying to help.
Operator, standing by. Till 5.
No, he's probably sitting. All right. Well, tonight... Well, okay. Thursday Night Football is going to be here for 5 years. It's a 5-year deal, $550 million a year with Fox. So CBS, NBC now out of Thursday Night Football. And it's not going to be Joe Buck and Troy Aikman evidently doing Thursday Night Football. They'll put their own team together, whether it's Kevin Burkhardt or Gus Johnson. I was kidding with Kevin Kugler today. I says, Cougs, this is your time.
Yeah, maybe Kenny Albert could do a game or two, depending on his schedule, though, with MSG, with Rangers hockey, though.
Well, no, he could do it. Sure. Now, it's going to be 18 games. 11 of them will be simulcast by Fox and NFL Network. The other 7 will be NFL Network only. The only Thursday they won't have will be Thanksgiving. But Fox already has a game on Thanksgiving anyway, but it will not be part of the Thursday Night Football package. $550 million, which is $100 million more than CBS and NBC paid combined last year. The quality of play may not be great on Thursday night, but it's here to stay. 5 years running through the 2022 season.
So if you're a fan of Big Bang Theory and you missed it Thursday nights on CBS, well, now the show isn't going anywhere. They won't have to change nights anymore.
No, it'll be canceled by the time that contract's up. We'll all be watching Young Sheldon. All right. So today's show brought to you by our good friends at Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Chris Soleri, final half hour on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC way? The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sean Curry with you, Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Steve on his way to the Breslin Center to cover Penn State Michigan State basketball tonight. Be able to hear that on the Penn State Sports Network, airtime at 6. And then tip at 6:30 with Steve and Dick Girardi. After we're finished with this show, Sarah Lauber will have our late-day news roundup. I'll take you till 7 o'clock tonight, then we'll have Shikellamy basketball on WKOK. With the suit, Kevin Hearn, the Chief Dave Ritchie. It is Jersey Shore tonight, coming down to Sunbury to take on the Braves in the Fieldhouse in the Phil Lockoff Gym. Just to let you know what we have coming up the rest of the week. Tomorrow we'll have Dennis Dodd from CBS Sports joining us. We'll talk more about the college football transfer rules, the new modification of the transfer rules that will be kicking in later this year. And Steve touched on that quite a bit earlier this week here on the show. Also tomorrow we'll start to talk a little bit of baseball, which is just a few weeks away from pitchers and catchers reporting. Scott Miller, the Major League Baseball national columnist from Bleacher Report, he'll be joining us tomorrow. Also tonight, by the way, more basketball over on Eagle 107 at 107.3. Bucknell will be taking on Army, 6:30 airtime, 7 o'clock tip with Doug Birdsong. Again, that's on 107.3 tonight. You can also listen to that on our WKOK app. Just tap Eagle 107 for the Bucknell play-by-play tonight on the network at 6:30. We will have Nathan Davis on the show tomorrow afternoon at 3:35. Scott Miller will join us at 4:06 tomorrow. We also have coming up, but before we wrap things up at the end of the week, Jeff Byers, the voice of Penn State Wrestling on the Penn State Sports Network. You got 1 vs. 2. The Wrestling Epicenter will be dialed into Rec Hall Saturday night for the sold-out showdown between Penn State and Ohio State. So we'll get Jeff's take on that dual meet. And, of course, we will wrap up the week with Steve's brother, Kevin Jones. He will check in from Connecticut on Friday afternoon. We'll get our Super Bowl 52 predictions in. As we mentioned, Steve is in Michigan State for Spartans Nittany Lions tonight. The Spartans dealing with quite a bit of controversy over the last week or so, spilling over to the basketball and the football programs following the sentencing of Larry Nassar. We're going to replay the interview we had for you on Monday with Michigan State basketball and football reporter Chris Soleri of the Detroit Free Press.
Yeah, good to talk to you, Steve, and I'm sure you guys are kind of watching this and kind of having flashbacks yourselves to big stories that just never seem to end.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. Never seems to end. All right, I want to start with this part. How tough has it been at times for the Detroit Free Press, even under the Freedom of Information Act, to get information from Michigan State?
So that's actually a great question and a great starting point. So prior to ESPN's lawsuit a few years ago, when they were getting police reports that were incomplete, we had those issues in Detroit. We had those issues when I was in Lansing, where you would get heavily redacted police reports and from Michigan State University police. Other law enforcement agencies don't do that. Michigan State University is hidden behind the Family Education and Rights Privacy Act during that time, and said that they had the right to black out names of victims and suspects in cases. And State Court of Appeals shot that down and said you need to release the names of the suspects involved in things in 2016 to ESPN. So really, for the first time, that kind of pried open the doors a little bit to what's happening on campus. We would be able to get to things that were off campus, you know, whether they were in East Lansing or some of the surrounding communities. But generally, the stuff on campus prior to that was virtually inaccessible. I mean, even if you did have a case number or a complaint date, you would get a heavily redacted report that you really couldn't write anything on.
All right, so now you have to wade your way through that. Now, in terms of the ability to get some information, I'll be honest with you, I'll sit down in May and in June, and I'll start putting together basics on charts for games. So Michigan State's always going to be there. And so I'd always have to sit there and say, okay, why isn't X on the roster? Well, he could have transferred or dropped out or whatever, or you find out X was arrested for whatever. So it's not like I didn't know about stuff like that. I did. What finally has opened the floodgates for you to get more information beyond just a basic arrest report?
Well, it's the names. And I mean, an arrest report is one thing, but having the names is a completely other thing. And that ESPN lawsuit in 2016 that I mentioned is what opened that up. And, you know, that's where we started to find some things in terms of football players and some basketball players. I focused solely on the football player incidents as part of the coverage. I've been investigating this for over a year now after the Michigan State had the two sexual assaults in 2017. And, you know, it wasn't as if there were a lot. I mean, there were, I believe, other than the two in 2017, there were four more at that point, one of which I reported on this summer, the Keith Mumphrey situation, the wide receiver from the Texans who was cut after we discovered through the Freedom of Information Act that in his police file there was documentation that he was banned from campus, so a police action, and that the university had expelled him. So we got a Title IX process. So that opened the gates to that, and then there were three other incidents during Mark Antonio's 11 years. Now, that's not necessarily a big number when you sit and think about it. I mean, you're talking, and this is solely sexual assaults. The ESPN story went into violence against women, which, you know, is a different situation, and they also rolled in basketball as well. But from what my investigation got, there were six cases over D'Antonio's first 11 years involving 11 players. Involved in sexual assaults or alleged sexual assaults, which again, not the number, that's, you know, when you think about the number of guys, 120 guys on a roster every given year, you know, you add plus or minus 25 per year, that's a relatively known number. But the bigger issue is that prior to that ESPN lawsuit, we didn't know what was going on. We did not know these cases existed.
Okay, so Chris, there's a way to handle it, and there's a university procedure to handle it, and there's a legal way to handle it. Has your reporting and your year-long investigation, did they follow university policy, and did they follow the law, at least what you know to this point?
By all accounts in the police reports, they did. and or you know the all of them ended up in the hands of the prosecutor. I found out about one today from the police that said that it was, while the prosecutor's office said it wasn't. It never got to them. But there were those cases, at least what we saw, they were obviously reported to police, and then they were investigated and forwarded to the county prosecutor, who determined not to press charges. So when you see that, the police report kind of gives you some bare bones on what is going on with it. And when there aren't charges brought, most places I've worked is to err on the side of the accused, especially in sexual assault cases. You know, you don't, and we did this in 2017 with the football players that were eventually named in Donnie Corley, Josh King, and Demetric Vance for their sexual assault that they had on a woman in January of a year ago. But until the charges were filed, there could have been any permutation of things. You could say they're in being investigated for sexual assault, and then get charged with something else. So you all of a sudden link those two things together if there are no charges. So kind of, that's what happened with one of the basketball cases that ESPN reported on. The other case is a whole different mess, because that supposedly was reported to the university athletic department and athletic director Mark Hollis and one of his underlings, and never filed a police report, never ended up in a campus judicial system. So there's that one in particular is sticky. But with the other case we had known about, there were no charges filed back in 2010, and that was the end of it. We got a prosecutor statement of why he did not press charges on the individuals, and we went with it.
This is going to be a tricky question, but I'll ask it anyway. Should Mark D'Antonio and Tom Izzo be far more worried about perception or about truth?
That's a good question, because I think if you asked both of them, they would be more about the truth. And I think that's, knowing them and being around them and having covered them, I think that would be their answer. That said, I think that they also understand where the perception comes from, too, that there's damage that comes with perception, and the damage is already done with perception. I mean, a week ago we were talking about Larry Nassar, and we were talking about the fallout from that. He hadn't even been sentenced at that point a week ago. And in that week, Michigan State lost its university president, who retired the day of the sentencing. Then Mark Hollis retires on Friday, about an hour or 2 hours before the gigantic ESPN story comes out. So how much of that is a result of perception of what was going on with Nassar? How much of that was anticipation of what was coming ahead with ESPN? I guess only those two can answer that. But the perception even right there is not good. And then you bring in Izzo, and he has what he called, he misspoke when he was discussing the Nassar situation a couple weeks ago, and one of the Olympic gymnast moms took to Twitter and berated him and his choice of words. Then you think about Mark D'Antonio, and a lot of these stories have focused on his program. I believe the ESPN report said that he personally handled one of those cases, and he came out Friday and said that was patently false, basically. And so, I mean, all of that ends up becoming perception anyways, regardless of where the case is at the moment.
In your year-long investigation, because you've poured a lot of sweat and equity into this along the way, you've had a lot of doors shut. Now that some doors have been open, have you found some people more willing to privately discuss, or have you still found doors to be solidly closed?
Well, I'd say the doors are still solidly closed, because you got to remember that this university right now is leadership in absentia. I mean, there's no president, there's no athletic director to discuss these things, which now puts Tom Izzo and Mark D'Antonio, who typically are the face of the university anyway, in really an unenviable position to either answer or at least face these questions. I mean, they have to face these questions. Whether or not they can or will answer, you know, I think is probably out of their hands and more in the legal team's hands at this point. Because when it comes down to it, you can be the face of the university, but you're still a basketball coach. You're still a football coach. And, you know, that's, I think, if there's a lesson that maybe Michigan State has learned from afar from seeing the Penn State situation, is trying to put that into perspective. You know, they and I think Tom Izzo tried to do that in speaking off from his heart, and, you know, I think he really had some poor choices of words when he was discussing the Larry Nassar situation that agitated the victims and the survivors of his abuse. So, I mean, there's certainly some crisis management going on in terms of the public image for Michigan State.
When Michaela Maroney came forward, that started an avalanche against Nassar. But when Allie Raisman stepped up, that put someone of fame and spotlight on Nassar. Are you surprised as a reporter, as hard as you've worked, are you surprised as a reporter that it steamrolled to suddenly football and basketball stemming from the Nassar thing? Because some would thought that would be the end, he'd go to prison, and obviously focusing on survivors would be critical. Are you surprised that it's spiraled the way it has in just a week?
Well, that could be a case of where the public perception versus the reality kind of, you start to question it, because, you know, are they directly tied to it? No. I mean, no one is sitting and saying that Mark D'Antonio and Tom Izzo had knowledge of, knew, or even understood who Larry Nassar was, let alone what he was doing. I mean, he did not work with their programs. I don't believe that they ever, I think Izzo said he'd never met him. Mark Hollis said he had never met him. He's the athletic director. You know, I think what you're seeing, I've heard someone use the term collateral damage, but I kind of hesitate to use that, because these things were underway before a lot of that Nassar stuff ramped up. Both our investigation and ESPN's investigation were going on for a while. And, you know, a lot of that stemmed from the football situation last year. So, you know, when you had one incident and then you had a second incident, then all of a sudden the microscope and the magnifying glass came out. And, you know, I think this is the continuation more of that than the Nassar situation. Maybe ESPN's timing on it could be tied to the Nassar situation, because there were a lot of eyes and a lot of resources that they had in East Lansing for that. But even still, I mean, you know, the Nassar situation, you know, when Michaela Maroney came out, when Allie Raisman came out, you know, and some of the other high-profile, prominent Olympic gymnasts, at least from a local standpoint, I think one of the moments of the victim impact statements that was most profound was when Jordan Weaver took the stand. Yeah. Because Jordan Weaver, right, is, outside of Magic Johnson, the biggest athlete in the Lansing community. And you're talking about someone who spent their entire life almost being treated by Larry Nassar. So, you know, and there were a lot of watershed moments throughout those victim impact statements that really kind of boiled, and I think maybe at some way and some level bubbled over, at least to the reactions to what we're seeing about the football and basketball programs.
Is it a community walking around in a state of shock?
I think it's in somewhat of a daze. I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, people were horrified and mortified with the Nassar situation. But I think it was the rapidity at which you saw the Nassar sentencing in an afternoon on a Wednesday, and then University President Luanda Simon resigns later that night, almost hastily. She was reportedly going to retire on Thursday, and instead put a letter on the university's website. And then Mark Hollis retires on Friday, hours before the ESPN story. So, I mean, it's, you know, I talked to a friend of mine over the weekend, because we had to go cover the game in Maryland. A friend of mine works for the Washington Post, and he kind of told me, he said, you know, this is kind of a little mini glimpse into what it's like to cover the Trump administration right now, because it is one story after another, and it's, you know, there is no news cycle. The news cycle is whenever you're awake, because something is happening at some point or another.
All right, hard one now, and you probably don't have a good answer for it, but I'll ask it anyway. What does it take for Mark D'Antonio and Tom Izzo to survive at Michigan State?
Yeah, I don't have a good answer for that right now. I mean, you know, Izzo's built up 23 years of cachet, and we're talking about two incidents, one of which was not reported to police. You know, you look objectively at that, and you think, okay, well, that's really pretty amazing when you sit and think about it. And then you look at Mark D'Antonio, and in 11 years, he's had issues. He's had some incidents in as recently as last year. And I mean, that's what the entire 2016-17, you know, early part of 17 calendar year was like. You know, it was a bad year off the field, and then everything bubbled over off the field. You know, the winning kind of helped. You know, if this was 2016, if this was a year ago at this time and all this came to the head like it is right now, I think that it would be impossible for a university to stick with him. But the other thing to keep in mind, there's no bosses. There's no athletic director. There's no president to make that call. So I don't even know who would make that call at this point. I don't think the Board of Trustees, which also are under some pretty significant heat for their handling of these situations, most particularly the Nassar situation, you know, there's fire on them. So I don't know who exactly, you know, just really, I mean, D'Antonio and Izzo are kind of on an island right now. They don't have a direct boss. No, there's no president. There's no athletic director.
Every time I talk to you, regardless, we were just talking football, basketball, you're always terrific. And thanks for some very thoughtful, insightful answers today.
Well, anytime, Steve. I appreciate the time.
Your station for news, weather, business, and CBS Sports Radio. News Radio 1070 WKOK Sunbury and on WKOK.com.